Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast site, my own website, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz or at Banking Day. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 9 in our series for 2024, and today's date is Friday, March the 29th, and yes, it's Good Friday. First, I'll be talking to Endeavour Environmental founder Matt Drum and his views on climate change and the impact this will have on the private sector. And I'll be talking to economist Nicholas Green about how Australia Post can improve its services in the bush by letting in some competition. But first, let's talk to Matt Drum.
Well, Matt, with all the legislation coming in, how should businesses prepare for net zero?
I suppose we're taking a step back. There's probably two cohorts of business that we need to think about. There's the legislation, obviously, we're referring to as a safeguard mechanism, which covers 217 of the largest emitters in the country. So big mining, big industrial processing, big manufacturing, these sorts of LNG, these sorts of sites. So maybe if we speak to those businesses first, in the context of how they need to prepare. I suppose the big thing about this legislation is it essentially turns or forces Australian business or this cohort of 217 into carbon accountants, which is what we've been doing for the last 15 years. We've been quite good at accounting our carbon, but have never really had a requirement to reduce it, except for that brief period when the carbon pricing mechanism was in 2012. So essentially what businesses need to do is they need to understand that the reduction, move from just counting emissions to reducing emissions, this is an incredible step change in complexity, capital requirements, operational market thinking and impacts that may occur to their business. And there will be a cost essentially on business. And what business need to do now is understand what that cost could be at a baseline, at a BAU component, and then start to prioritise emissions reduction activities based on lowest cost to highest cost, and also understand how offsets and a new derivative that's being created by this legislation called safeguard mechanism credits can interplay to essentially continue their activities, reduce their emissions, but do so at least cost.
What you're saying is they need to audit their emissions.
Well, essentially they already know what their emissions are because, as I say, we've been reporting it for a long period of time. But there's been no impost to reduce. But now under the safeguard mechanism, the majority of businesses will be required to reduce their emissions by 4.9% per annum. Now, that is a significant impost, a significant almost transformational type projects that are going to be required. I might just give you just a very sort of rough case study just to try to, and this is a theoretical case study, to try to put it into context, Leon. So if I've got a facility, one of the 217, that's currently emitting 1 million tonnes of CO2 per annum, they're required as of this coming financial year, by the end of it, to have delivered a net reduction of 49,000 tonne for that period to hit their 4.9% reduction target. Now, just to put that into context, 49,000 tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalents is equivalent to the emissions of around 2,700 Australian households. So it's a big effort, and that's just for 1 year. That's going to continue year after year after year. So in this theoretical case study, we're talking about the 24 financial year. This business hasn't had a chance to introduce, you know, these transformational or these high impact carbon reduction activities, which might be a fuel switch or a big energy efficiency project or the like. So they're going to have to meet their 49,000 ton reduction by the purchase of carbon offsets, Australian carbon credit units to be precise, or ACCUs we call them, or safeguard mechanism credits that are created by other entities within the 217 safeguard cohort, which may be able to produce these safeguard mechanism credits if they have actually reduced their actual emissions. So, but just say they have to purchase ACCUs or offsets and safeguard mechanism credits. If you run a rough estimate or sort of maybe a high cap on what those units might cost each, I've used $75 as the price for each one of those units, whether they're carbon offsets or safeguard mechanism credits. 49,000 times $75 equals $3.765 million cost to that facility in year one to meet their safeguard requirements. So that's not chicken feed.
And that's an ongoing cost.
That is an ongoing cost. But theoretically, and this is sort of leading into what businesses should do now. What businesses need to understand, businesses will have a whole range of opportunities to reduce their emissions. And each one of those opportunities will vary in scale, in as much as how much they'll be able to reduce their emissions, and they'll vary in cost to implement, to operate, to acquire, et cetera. And they'll vary in cost per ton of emissions that they need to, that they can reduce by. So essentially how you prioritize which activities you do in what order and why, one of the first things you need to do is develop what we call a marginal abatement cost curve. And sorry, I'm getting into significant lingo here, but that's essentially working out which is the cheapest, most impactful opportunity I can invest to the most expensive, least impactful. And theoretically, you work from the bottom of that curve up to the top of that curve, implementing the cheapest, most impactful activities first. And that's how MAC works. And that's what businesses need to understand, because these projects are going to need finance. They're going to need approvals, both financial approvals and potentially development approvals. They're going to need hardware and equipment, install, purchase, commissioning, et cetera, et cetera. It's a long-term play, and this policy is a long-term policy, but some of these bigger projects are obviously a long-term play and need to be bought into the business's, you know, longer term horizon.
That's at significant costs for the business.
Yeah, there will be costs, but potentially there will also be savings. You know, if you're doing a big energy efficiency project, for example, we all know energy costs are going through the roof. If you're implementing a project that saves significant amounts of energy over, it might have a payback period of 2 or 3 or 4 years. After that 2 or 3 or 4 years is up, that is particularly could be a cost, you know, cost negative opportunity. So it depends. Over the long term, some of them will, and factoring in the cost of carbon, which we now have, some of them will have positive returns sooner rather than later.
Can you give me examples of success stories in this?
Yeah, sure. One of our clients that we've worked with, and this is all in the public domain, is Orica, big manufacturer of explosive products and the like. Orica, their Kooragang Island decarbonisation project. Orica is an example of an organisation that has acted early. They acted before the safeguard mechanism was in play, and they've gone through this MAC type approach. Found a really good decarbonisation project, involved significant capital investment. There was ability to cost in certain benefits for implementing that prior to the safeguard mechanism. And because of that, that project's going to save about 4.5 million tonne over the life, I think out till 2030. That's going to put them in a very good position for their safeguard going forward. So a lot of their action that will be required on the safeguard mechanism has already been completed. But that was a multi-million dollar project. And it's a good example of the types of projects that will have to be invested in and implemented again and again across these 217 heavy emitters.
That's going to require a lot of forward planning.
Yeah, certainly. And that's why there's a few aspects to it, Leon. There's the forward planning component. Again, understanding which activities should be prioritised and why. The other things to consider are, because there is now an implicit cost on carbon at the site level, making sure that your reporting is accurate, your reporting of emissions, which has a financial implication, is accurate and also timely. Most organisations or most of these facilities will only report once a year to the regulator because that's all they're required to do. But because there are financial implications and other implications, you know, a suggestion would be to move to monthly or quarterly, at least, internal reporting, so you can understand the impacts of your emissions profile on your balance sheet and P&Ls. So that's two things that businesses really need to think about and will help that forward planning.
It's interesting because I've read environmental reports from large companies, large listed companies.
Yep.
And they're a bit all over the place and very vague.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you found that too?
With regards to their response to the safeguard mechanism?
Not just safeguard mechanism policies, but environmental issues generally.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, I think there has been, if I focus it on the climate space, which is sort of real area of expertise, you know, we've seen a lot of net zero targets being set by organisations. Once upon a time, the standard was to set a net zero target by 2050. The expectation from investors and other stakeholders certainly is that should be, that time horizon needs to come closer, 2040, 2035 time frames are becoming more and more the norm. And some of those targets and how organisations are going to reach them can and are by necessity somewhat vague, because you don't know what technology is going to be available at 2035, and at what cost in 2040. So there is, by, as I said, necessity, a level of vagueness there. And you know, the organisations caught on the safeguard mechanism won't necessarily know, particularly if they haven't done their homework, what they're going to be looking at in 2030. And even if they do their homework, there's going to be hard to abate sectors that are going to be relying on green hydrogen and these types of things. And the jury's still out on some of those technologies and whether they can be scalable and delivered at the right price.
So there's a whole lot of unknowns in here as well that companies have to deal with.
There is, but yeah, there's certainly some short-term things that need to be dealt with. And we've seen a lot of organisations covered under the safeguard, probably sitting on their hands a little bit. And that's probably a response to the fact that we've had 10 years of climate wars and failed climate and energy policies. And a lot of these companies have invested time and effort into these historic policies that never eventuated. So there's probably been a bit of inaction based on that, not by all, but certainly by some. There's also been inaction because we all knew that the Greens were going to be involved in this decision-making process and the legislative process, and which way they were going to go was up in the air until just recently. They've signed on. But certainly, organisations need to start understanding the impact at a cost base and also their ability to pass through those costs into their supply chain and to their clients, what their contracts and supply contracts to clients look like. Is there a change of regulation cause? One of the other big ticket items of this policy is the trade exposure component. So if you can demonstrate significant impact on revenues that this policy will have on your organization due to your being trade exposed and not being able to pass on those costs, because you're working in a global market, then that actually allows you, rather than having a 4.9% reduction per annum, you can actually have a more minimal reduction applied to your facility, which might be 1 or 2%, which obviously is a pretty big break. It gives you a bit more time and a bit more leeway.
Well, Matt, that's quite fascinating, and I'm sure businesses will welcome this and study it closely. Thank you very much for your time.
No worries, Leon.
And now let's talk to economist Nicholas Green.
Nicholas, you've argued that Australia Post enjoys two monopolies, not one. What do you mean, and why does it matter?
So we're all familiar, I think, with the fact that Australia Post has a legislated monopoly on letters. And the purpose of that monopoly for the whole of Federation has been that it costs a little bit less to deliver mail in, well, quite a lot less to deliver mail in dense areas in the city and quite a lot more to deliver it in the country. And Australians are perfectly happy with the cross-subsidy that is involved in saying that a letter can get anywhere in Australia for the cost of a stamp. So that's a cross-subsidy, an intended cross-subsidy from the city to the bush. Now, Australia Post is concerned about the fact that letters are getting less and less important, but it has another monopoly, and that's a natural monopoly. A natural monopoly arises when a business has an asset which it's uneconomic for anyone else to duplicate. A rail line is a good example. And the last mile of Australia Post network in the bush in regional Australia is uneconomic to duplicate. And what Australia Post is doing is it is milking that natural monopoly. And then you can ask, where's the money going? So the money's coming from the bush because of the bush is where the monopoly is. And it's going where you would expect it to go, where an economist would expect it to go, and that is into unfairly competing in the city. It's being used to cross-subsidise the city from the bush. And I was asked by Christine Holgate, my company Lateral Economics is doing some work for Christine Holgate, her company TGE. TGE is a logistics company. It delivers parcels and does a lot of bulk carriage. It, in fact, is a subcontractor to Australia Post, has a very large network, and it wants to use Australia Post's network, the last mile of the network in regional Australia, so that it can give regional Australians a better deal. And guess what? Australia Post doesn't want to give regional Australians a better deal. It's too busy milking that monopoly.
So what's the impact of this on deliveries in the bush?
Well, the deliveries in the bush, they've essentially, if you want to send something to, let's say you're an online retailer and you want to send something, let's say you're RM Williams and you want to send some boots to somebody, they're made in regional Australia and you want to send them all around the country. You have to do that with Australia Post. And that means that Australia Post tells you that it will take 2 weeks, although sometimes it takes more, to deliver it. Compare that with what's going on in the city with Amazon, next day delivery a lot of the time. It costs more, and quite a lot of online retailers are not supplying the bush because it just ends in grief. They get too many calls, too many people saying, where's my stuff? They get the blame for what is in effect somebody else's problem. So it's making service much worse. It's keeping the online revolution, the online retailing revolution from regional Australia, and it's reducing economic growth. So Lateral Economics did a study. We reckon over 10 years, this is costing the country about $1.5 billion. And if we allowed not just TGE, but any company that wanted to access the last mile to do so at commercially negotiated and fair rates, that would generate about 2,000 jobs, about 1,000 of those in the bush.
So, I mean, other companies could include, say, RM Williams or Chemist Warehouse?
Yeah, and the way in which it would be done is that they would contract with Australia Post or TGE or DHL or FedEx. A large company would provide this service, and they would say to them, we'll deliver anywhere in Australia and here are our rates. And you would then get some competition to deliver in the bush, because at the moment there is no competition.
Well, Australia Post claims falling letter volumes undermine its viability in the bush. I mean, what's your view about that?
Well, its letter revenue is barely going down. It's not precipitate. But the really important thing here, I think, is that you can distinguish.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Between meeting these problems by rationalizing and contracting, and that's exactly what Australia Post is suggesting. It's talking about closing post offices and slowing down deliveries. Or you can take post offices and the postal network as the nation building social and economic infrastructure that it is. And you can say, how do we make the most of that? How do we grow it? That's exactly what had happened. In fact, it was Christine Holgate when she was in Australia Post. She got there. The banking at Post wasn't a success. It needed a lot more investment. And she managed to make it a major feature of post offices and turned that around, and it became a major source of revenue for Australia Post. That is the kind of thing that needs to now happen in parcels. It needs to be thought of as something to be grown, not something to be milked.
Well, Australia Post is actually making a lot of money out of parcels, aren't they?
They are, but they're using a part of that is a cross subsidy from the city to the bush. And if we made that more competitive, they'd be forced to do what they should be doing, which is to improve their efficiency and compete on a fair basis with other businesses, particularly in the bush.
So you're saying Australia Post does not want to compete?
I think that's a fair summary of what I'm saying. It's tough. Businesses don't want to compete. Businesses invest and they innovate to try and generate monopoly rents. That's kind of okay. But businesses love monopolies, and monopolies that they earned are one thing. Monopolies that they've been sitting on for 100 years are another. And monopolies that are fairly easily unpicked by policy are another thing again. The interesting thing about this is that a lot of this sort of politics, you've got this, for instance, competition policy generally, you had a lot of rural communities being against some of the changes, and they had some good reasons for that. They have no reason for this. That's why I think the National Party are pretty strongly supportive of this. But every political party should be supportive of this, because there is only one beneficiary from this monopoly, and that is the people at Australia Post. The rural post offices have a strong interest in this because they would then be in a position to be doing more business. So rural communities have an interest. It's not protecting anyone who can vote. And so I think it's not long for this world. Let's hope so.
So what sort of policies should the government bring in?
Well, essentially, the relevant minister should direct Australia Post to negotiate fair commercial terms with any firm that wants to use this network, and that should be supervised by the ACCC. It just should be a normal part of Australian competition policy. And it's kind of an anomaly that it wasn't. It's a little bit like the bizarre goings on in the UK with regard to post offices. Because post offices are such ancient institutions, at least by modern standards, they have had their own institutional framework. And there's no real reason for that now.
So, and this sort of policy would probably have bipartisan support, you'd say?
It will have bipartisan support if the government isn't snowed by Australia Post. Ministers are often fairly anxious that they're not sure that if they do something will go wrong. So they take the advice of people who come to meet them a lot and look serious. But the message that Australia Post is trying to send is you need to do this to help our viability. Often the implication is to help our viability in the bush. But if politicians and communities understand that that is like a magician's misdirection, that is a cover for they want you to buy the letter story, but in fact, the parcel story is the exact opposite of what they're saying. They want the ability to continue to exploit the bush. And that's why I think this strategy is doomed, and they really should they should give up gracefully now, but they will be forced to. It's a question of time.
Well, Nicholas, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Leon.
So what's happening in the news? Well, the number of people using X daily is falling more than a year after tech billionaire Elon Musk bought the app formerly known as Twitter. Data from two research firms and figures published by Musk and X to suggest a deteriorating situation for X by some metrics. Musk has marketed as the world's town square, but in number of users, it continues to lag far behind social media rivals that focus on video, such as Instagram and TikTok. In February, X had 27 million daily active users of its mobile app in the US, down 18% from a year earlier, according to Sensor Tower, a market intelligence firm based in San Francisco. The US user base has been flat or down every month since November 2022, the first full month of Musk's owning the app, and in total is down 23% since then, Sensor Tower said. The numbers were nearly as bad worldwide, as daily active users on the mobile app fell to 174 million in February, down 15% from a year earlier, the firm said. The worldwide user base has been flat or down every month during Musk's tenure, began except one when it grew slightly in October, and then resumed falling, according to Sensor Tower. Other social media apps experienced modest increases in their worldwide user bases during the same period, according to the research, with Snapchat growing 8.8%, Instagram 5.3%, Facebook 1.5%, and TikTok 0.5%. Those apps all experienced declines over that period in the US, but none was as steep as the decline on X. X had the most material decline in active users compared to its peers, Abe Youssef, a senior insights analyst at Sensor Tower, wrote in a research report. This decline in X mobile app users may have been driven by user frustration over flagrant content, general platform technical issues, and the growing threat of short-term video platforms, he wrote. Under Musk's ownership, X has relaxed content moderation rules that previously limited hateful content, such as white supremacist imagery, and Musk has welcomed back to the platform some users whom the old Twitter management had banned. In December, he reinstated the accounts of conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and his InfoWars website, and then held a public audio-only event with Jones. And Australia's monthly headline consumer price index flatlined at 3.4% in annual terms in February, unchanged from the previous month, undershooting consensus forecast of 3.5% and 3.6%. And unions will push for a 5% increase to the minimum wage for more than 2.9 million workers, while employers will demand a major pay slowdown to offset record increases that overcompensated for inflation. The Australian Council of Trade Unions announced it will call on the Fair Work Commission to lift the national minimum wage from $3.23 to $24.39 an hour this year, and the full-time annual rate by $2,295 to $48,200. The increase, which would flow to more than 100 industry awards, would cement Australia as having one of the world's highest minimum wages in nominal terms, second only to Luxembourg. It comes as unions in New South Wales, including those representing construction workers and 15,000 rail corps workers, pursue pay rises of between 5% and 8% a year in moves officials hope will trigger broader wage rises across the country. Despite last year's record increase of 5.75%, ACTU Secretary Sally McManus said workers on awards were still $5,200 worse off after inflation had eaten away their pay rises over the past 3 years. And Jackie Lambie will demand the Liberals agree to boost transparency in Tasmania's political system and rethink plans for a $715 million AFL stadium in Hobart in exchange for a deal to return Premier Jeremy Rockliffe to power. In the wake of Saturday's inconclusive election results, the Liberals are on track to take up to 15 seats in the expanded lower house of 35 members. As many as three Jackie Lambie network candidates are expected to win seats, potentially offering Mr. Rockliffe a path through the chaos. But the federal senator said they would push for the state's integrity commission to get new powers and calls for tax breaks for small business, truth in political advertising laws, and faster turnaround times for freedom of information requests are also on the table. Senator Lambie said the state's integrity commission needed to be given new powers, suggesting it had basically never heard a case. She will also push for more transparency around the AFL stadium development, demanding the contract be provided to new MPs. Any changes to the agreement with the league over the stadium, which was a key issue in the campaign, could be a political nuisance for Mr. Rockliffe. I'm hoping there's a prospect that it can certainly be adjusted because Tasmania just cannot afford that, she said. We do not have a resource sector like Western Australia does. We don't have gold-plated road. And Peter Dutton has committed the coalition to develop laws that could extend to forcibly breaking up Coles and Woolworths after he stepped in to stop the Nationals working with the Greens to rein in supermarket power. Mr. Dutton intervened with National leader David Littleproud this week, blocking fledgling cooperation with Green Senator Nick McKim on proposed forced divestment laws. He has previously stressed any changes must benefit consumers, but promised action on market concentration. It will come as no surprise that it is a principle of our party not to look to the Greens for leadership on how to manage the economy, the opposition leader told coalition MPs at Parliament House. This development coincided with the companies facing intense scrutiny on their pricing practices from shoppers and Parliament, and new Australian Bureau of Statistics data on Tuesday showing that some of the claims of price gouging were exaggerated, with the cost of food and non-alcoholic beverages in Australia increasing by less than those in New Zealand, the UK, Canada, the US and the EU. And CoreLogic's Home Value Index has shown an impressive growth of 8.9% over the past year, boosting the national median dwelling value by about $63,000 to $765,762 and reaching a new peak in February, driving up the cost of rent over inflation. That's despite worsening of affordability, rising cost of living and rate hikes. This has also increased the cost of rent. CoreLogic has attributed this to the increasingly entrenched undersupply in housing stock and above-average demand thanks to strong net migration. And the team at Oxford Economics Australia says that a combination of factors is exacerbating the housing construction crunch, including a 40% increase in construction costs, high upfront charges, higher interest rates and savage competition for skilled labour from Australia's booming infrastructure sector, which faces a skills gap of about 230,000 people. The profitability of developers and builders is poor, but high interest rates means affordability is also poor. The lack of supply feeds through to Oxford's forecast for house prices, which it expects will rise 2.4% in 2024. But senior economist Marie Kilroy says the prospect for interest rate cuts will boost affordability in 2025 and 26, when she expects national house prices to rise between 7% and 8%. Rental growth is expected to run above the rate of inflation until 2026. Interest rate cuts will provide more relief. But if Oxford's price predictions are right, those locked out of the market will find any affordability benefit from lower rates will instantly disappear due to higher prices. And Commonwealth Bank has invested in a startup working with global banks to create standards for screening financial crime and cross-border payments against the international sanctions list. CBA, which has put an executive onto the board of three-year-old London-based Global Screening Services, joins Japanese bank MUFG as a shareholder after backing its US $47 million, that's Aussie $72 million, capital raising. It could deploy GSS for international payments next year once final testing is completed, with around 40 global banks trying to reduce the number of legitimate payments being blocked. Sanctions lists, which include the names of people and companies governments prevent banks from dealing with, have swollen on the back of rising geopolitical risks, including Russia's invasion of Ukraine. They were also a favoured foreign policy tool of Donald Trump's White House. The proliferation of sanctions makes banks nervous of unwittingly facilitating criminal activity, exposing them to stiff penalties and reputational damage. Over the past 5 years, the number of names on 50 global government sanctions list has grown by 300%, GSS estimates. Australia's own consolidated list, managed by the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, has 9,500 names. Meanwhile, the US list, managed by the Office of Foreign Assets Control inside Treasury, runs to 2,000 pages. Mistakes can be costly. French bank BNP Paribas was fined almost US $9 billion in 2014 after pleading guilty in the US to conspiring to violate US sanctions against the governments of Sudan, Iran and Cuba. ANZ has also run foul of the US over transactions linked to Sudan and Cuba between 2004 and 2006, which resulted in a $7 million settlement in 2009. An Australian medical company is teaching cutting-edge trauma surgery to Ukrainian doctors as they grapple with the reality of a war dominated by deadly unmanned drones, which have fundamentally altered the battlefield. Canberra-based Aspen Medical has partnered with the US-based Henry M. Jackson Foundation for the Advancement of Military Medicine to undertake a study into Ukraine's combat casualty care and the lessons from the first large-scale country-to-country conflict fought in Europe since World War II. Commissioned by the US Department of Defense, the findings are being used to buttress Ukraine's medical capabilities through data analysis and training and develop lessons for US and allied forces. Aspen Medical's chief of mission in Ukraine, Terry Rauch, said a critical early finding stemmed from the tactical use of drones on the battlefield, an early hallmark of the conflict. Drones limit timely movement as they scour battlefields hunting for troops, leading to complications from tourniquet use, where in Iraq and Afghanistan, severely wounded people were airlifted to treatment quickly, reducing these risks. Ukrainians are being forced to wait for hours on the battlefield before receiving early care. Ukrainians face multi-day journeys from the war-torn east to safe care in the country's west. An estimated 25,000 people in Ukraine have lost limbs to conflict-related amputations. A key outcome of the Aspen Medical-led research has been the adaptation of tactical combat casualty recommendations by Allied forces for the use of tourniquets. More than 40 medical clinicians working in Ukraine have been trained in advanced trauma care under the US $10 million Aspen Medical-led program, which is preparing them for the intricacies of the battlefield injuries that appear on their operating tables. Noting the high amputation rate since the war began, the Alcoa Foundation in February announced a $300,000 grant with Aspen Medical to partner with the First Medical Union of Lviv to provide prosthetic limbs tailored to meet individual needs along with the necessary rehabilitation care. The wartime medical care study also includes monthly symposia in Poland's capital Warsaw, bringing together experts including civilian and military physicians, nurses, hospital administrators and policymakers. Politically astute Aspen has always seized opportunities. During COVID, it got $57 million in coronavirus contracts. This included the provision of 35 surge staff to contain an outbreak at the Newmarch House aged care facility in Sydney's west, setting up 100 pop-up respiratory clinics around the country, screening and testing crew members on the cruise ship Ruby Princess, and sourcing personal protective equipment, PPE, for the federal government's national medical stockpile. Founded by former Australian Defence Force member Glenn Keyes in 2003, the Canberra-based Aspen Medical has since become a major privatised medical provider. It has worked as a defence contractor and as an operator in Australia's offshore immigration detention network, providing medical services at Nauru Hospital. The company has strong political ties. Michael Waldridge, a former Howard government health minister, spent 10 years as a director of Aspen over two periods between 2007 and 2019. And that's it for this week. And next week I'll be talking to GARPA HR advisory, Aaron McEwen, to talk about the future of work, people strategy, talent management strategies and practices, well-being and mental health, and employee value propositions. And I'll be talking to Indeed economist Callum Pickering about the latest unemployment figures. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. If you like Talking Business, please leave us a review with Apple Podcasts. Thank you in advance. In the meantime, you can catch me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube. And if you want, leave a comment. If you want to contact me, email me at leon@leongettler.com. I answer all emails. Wishing you all a safe and healthy week. And please have an excellent Easter with your friends and family. And looking forward to bringing Talking Business next week.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.